It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. About 8,000 people each year, they experience what is called a non-fatal drowning, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, meaning the person survives but may sustain a serious injury. We discuss emergency care for drowning victims and water safety, and you can ask a question. Add your comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tyler Bovey is a trauma coordinator and registered nurse at HSHS Sacred Heart Hospital in Eau Claire and St. Joseph's Hospital in Chippewa Falls. Tyler, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much for having me on this morning.
Good morning. So let's take a scenario here where a person comes through the emergency room after nearly drowning. They're unconscious, not breathing. How does your trauma team handle drowning cases?
So at our facility, our first thing is we're going to get our team there, like you said, the trauma team. We're going to have the whole team available and ready to treat this patient, assuming they're coming in by EMS services. And what we're going to do is assess them, and if they're unconscious and not breathing, we're going to have to work on an appropriate airway and appropriate ventilation for the patient, so something like an endotracheal tube and a breathing machine.
What about damage to the organs of the body in moments like this, in a drowning? How does the brain get affected, the heart? What is happening internally?
So with drowning victims, the big issue that we have is hypoxia, is lack of oxygen to the patient. And that leads to all different sorts of problems across all different body systems. Really, a couple to highlight are neurologic and cardiac function. Obviously, our muscles need oxygen to function, and our brain needs oxygen to continue having us work the way we do. The longer our body goes without oxygen, the worse our outcomes are. And long-term, we can be talking about some significant neurologic dysfunction.
How do you try to limit or reduce brain injury in the initial treatment phase with a patient?
Our goal at that initial phase is to get the patient, in a hospital setting would be to get them breathing appropriately again, so return oxygenation. So again, breathing tube, breathing machines, looking at do we need to put a little bit of pressure behind our breaths that we're giving the patient to help push some water out of their lungs? Do we need to give them more concentrated oxygen? We start to get as creative as possible in trying to create the best outcome for the patient.
The CDC says more than 40% of drownings treated in an emergency department do require hospitalization for further care. How do you treat patients then going forward after the emergency has ended in a case of drowning?
Some of these patients can still be just absolutely incredibly critical. So we are looking at how do we maintain their breathing and obviously maintain their cardiovascular status. We look at things like antibiotics for possible aspiration of water. You reflexively will eventually take a breath in. And what kind of water was the person in? Was it a pool or maybe a pond or a river where we have some more concern for infectious agents? And then we also really have to monitor their temperature. It's one of those things we don't always think about, but I'm thinking about our Great Lakes here. Patients that come out of those bodies of water can be incredibly cold. So you can have kind of a hypothermia component on top of all the other things that are going on with your patient.
And, you talk about rivers and lakes, very cold water. Can you step back and give us some insight on what are the signs of drowning?
So I know when we see on the movies, we see patients, flailing and screaming, help, I'm drowning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that's not necessarily realistic. When people are drowning, their respiratory status is compromised. So their breathing is compromised. If you're not breathing, you don't really make much sound. And oftentimes people are trying to swim. So they're actually, their limbs are underwater. So it's not this flopping, thing that we typically see on the TV. You might only see somebody just maybe with their face out of the water, or you might unfortunately see someone just floating, or you might not see somebody that was present just a second ago.
it just slipping away. And that's why it can be so scary for someone who said, well, I saw them there. They were just there. I'm going to reintroduce you, Tyler Bovey, with us, trauma coordinator at HSHS Sacred Heart and St. Joseph's Hospitals in Western Wisconsin, as we talk about drowning, water safety. You can join in with your questions and your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Tyler, let's turn to prevention. How can drownings be prevented?
Oh, this is key. Preventing drownings is going to do so much for people. So a lot of our patients, drowning victims, are young. We talk about, you know, a lot of pediatric patients under 5 years old that are having these drowning or near drowning events. So focusing on pediatric patients, having kids supervised around water at all times, just period, by an adult. Having your pool fenced in, and having an appropriate and proper life jacket on. There's all different kinds of flotation devices that are sold, but really looking for like the Coast Guard seal of approval on the life jacket for what the patient is doing. If they're boating or swimming or alone or in a group, as well as the size of the person and the appropriate fit of the life jacket.
I've also heard the tip of being an arm's length away, no farther than an arm's length away. Is that okay, or do we need to be closer?
I think that can kind of be individualized based on the patient and their age and family members and what they're wearing for a flotation device. It's a kind of a complex one, but it is very, very easy for someone to slip under the water. And a lot of our rivers and streams are not super clear. Once that person's under, they might not be where you think they were.
Can drowning occur in shallow water?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Anywhere that your face or head can be underwater is a possibility of a drowning scenario.
And what about CPR and how people administer it with a drowning victim? What would you suggest?
As soon as we can get CPR started on a patient that has gone pulseless after a drowning, that's when we need to be doing it. Early intervention for these patients is really one of the key pieces to long-term good outcomes.
Is CPR performed any differently with drowning victims? I'm just thinking about all of the water inhaled and where that water goes, lungs and elsewhere. Does that at all interfere with the proper CPR steps?
No, we're going to continue to do CPR as we've been trained. So if you've been trained by like the American Heart Association, follow that training. There is some discussion about rescue breaths being maybe arguably slightly more important for drowning victims. But I think really the important thing is to start CPR and follow the way you were trained.
Can you explain about when to do chest compressions? Because, you know, you want to check for pulses, I would imagine, before you want to start those chest compressions?
Yeah, that's correct. The first thing you do is you would check for a pulse on a patient, and adult patients you're thinking more of up on the neck, and the pediatric patients there's a couple of different spots depending on their age and their size. But what you want to make sure is that there is an absence of a pulse before you go ahead and start the CPR.
How do you stay calm in those moments when you're trying to find that subtle pulse and yet, you know, mind and heart is racing, maybe people are gathering? Do you have any suggestions for how to stay really focused there and you know, really know the signs up for that pulse?
That's such a great question. In these moments, we get such a rush of adrenaline, and sometimes that can kind of interfere with good decision making. I think the important thing is to take a deep breath. The interventions that you do with that person are really only going to help them in that case.
Tyler Bovey is a registered nurse at HSHS Sacred Heart Hospital in Eau Claire and St. Joseph's Hospital in Chippewa Falls, our guide in this discussion on how to prevent drownings. And you can be part of this. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Unintentional drownings peak this time of year. That's according to the CDC's fatal injury trends. We learn how to reduce risks while swimming in open water and how to save a life. And you can be part of this. Call in with a question, share a comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tyler Bovey is a trauma coordinator and registered nurse at HSHS Sacred Heart Hospital in Eau Claire and St. Joseph's Hospital in Chippewa Falls. Tyler, the CDC reports drowning is the leading cause of death for children ages 1 to 4. And you say that children are more likely to drown in a swimming pool. Why is that?
You know, I don't know if I have a specific reason that I've come across, but I think it has something to do with our comfort. If this is your home swimming pool, your kids have been in it several times, everybody's very comfortable. I think there's a level of almost complacency that can happen, and that can lead to us not supervising the kids in the pool and can lead to these drownings.
Kind of letting your guard down, thinking that everyone knows the ropes here at home, where you would be more alert perhaps to in a water area that you haven't been a part of before, you haven't seen.
Absolutely.
So, you know, when the CDC says that the unintentional drownings peak this time of year, do you see that type of peak in the hospitals?
You know, thankfully, we don't see a whole ton of drownings. And I think that's a lot to do with prevention and education and getting things like life jacket loaners out there. But if we do see drownings, it does tend to be a little bit more in these summer months where we have so many more people in the water, whether it be at home or out on the lakes and rivers.
When you say life jacket loaners, meaning just people having access to life jackets?
There are several stations set up across Wisconsin for life jacket loaners, like a loaner board that the state of Wisconsin's done with some of their outstanding partners, where there are just life jackets that people can borrow for the day. And that whole point was to try to prevent drownings.
And you say that children should wear a life jacket even if they're strong swimmers. How can you judge that or, in terms of when it is okay to take off a life jacket versus make sure they have one on?
Yeah, I think it's important for children to be wearing a life jacket in the water, just period. I think that's a strong statement that we need to make. Given they may be strong swimmers, they may be a whole different gamut of things. But the important thing to realize about kids is they don't have quite the complex decision-making skills that adults end up having. There might be a little bit more risk-taking behavior. They might not see the outcomes quite as clearly. And then they're also not as strong and don't have quite as much reserve as say, an adult would.
And then water currents, especially in rivers, that those two can be not easy to assess for any type of swimmer.
Correct. And those unknown situations are where that life jacket is going to come in and really save you or save your child.
Do you have any tips for making sure the life jacket fits correctly for the size of the child or the adult?
When you're purchasing a life jacket, there should be a size, a weight-based, and then an activity with these, and that's all run through the U.S. Coast Guard. The Coast Guard will help determine what you'd be using this for. So there are some life jackets that are made for adults who are going to be out fishing by themselves. There are some made for whitewater rafting. There are some made for pediatric patients. There's good and bad swimmers. There's some that even have kind of a neck around them that'll help keep someone's head up out of the water if they weren't able to continue to tread. So they're all different things to look at when you purchase the life jacket, but then making sure that that tag and that explanation of what the life jacket is to be used for matches what you're going to be using it for.
It sounds like the technology built into life jackets has evolved since some of the basic ones from past.
Absolutely. And I think technology is going to continue to improve on these to make them maybe a little bit more comfortable to wear. But I don't think at any point we should be trading comfort for safety.
Some kids like to wear water wings. Do they provide some of the same safety support as a life jacket?
we couldn't recommend wearing water wings in place of a life jacket.
Okay.
Those are going to, you know, if you think about where those are on a kid, those are going to keep the arms up a little bit. But if that person can no longer tread water, can no longer keep their head up, those are not going to help keep your torso or your face out of the water so that you can breathe.
In when it's an accident where it is a drowning victim is able to have a stronger recovery and regain more fuller function, can you talk a little bit about those cases versus the severe cases?
Yeah, I think a lot of the recovery ends up having to do with how long the person was without oxygen. So the shorter, the better, obviously. But it can still be a really long and hard road for these patients to recover. When the brain goes without oxygen for an extended period of time, it sustains significant damage. And that can manifest in a whole variety of different ways, from speech and cognition difficulties to movement problems to memory issues. And that can really run the gamut as well, from mild to severe.
What types of clinicians, what types of doctors deal with these after effects from near drownings?
Initially, it's going to be the emergency room team, but from there, it's going to end up with the hospitalist or critical care team. And likely after that, we're going to be working with physical and occupational therapy. And then there are therapy-specific providers that do long-term rehab. We do have a hospital, within a hospital at Sacred Heart, that does specific rehab.
Specific rehab for these kinds of issues after an accident. I'm going to reintroduce you here for just a moment. We're talking about drowning prevention and the treatment protocols with registered nurse Tyler Bovee, a trauma coordinator at HSHS Sacred Heart and St. Joseph's Hospitals in Western Wisconsin. You can join the conversation at any point. Call in with a question or a comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tyler, in terms of your trauma team, what type of training has your team received in order to be able to respond to these emergencies with drownings very quickly and systematically? Can you talk a little bit about how that team works together?
The team works together so incredibly well. Start with our emergency room providers, our ER physicians. They're all board certified emergency room physicians. So that is their specialty, and that is what they find the most joy in. Our nursing team takes some specific courses, some specific trauma and pediatric courses on top of having their nursing licensure. And then we also have some incredibly gifted respiratory therapists that do specific training on airway and breathing and how to help with those interventions. We get together in a group and we will start just from the top. We have a systematic assessment that we do and systematic interventions that we all train on. And really, if you're able to see that at any point, it's a really impressive thing to see 10, 15, maybe 20 people all working in tandem without stepping on each other.
You know, this conversation can sound very scary to be around water and to do water type outings. How do you make sure that you manage the risks involved, but also not become so scared of water?
Yeah, I don't think anybody wants to discourage the short but beautiful summer that we have here in Wisconsin. We get these warm temperatures. We do want people to enjoy the time outside and in the water, but do so safely. You know, with the life jackets on your children, with the life jackets on adults that are boating, by limiting alcohol use while you're on the water.
Well, Tyler, I appreciate you joining us, and thank you so much for these insights on drowning prevention.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me this morning.
That was Tyler Bovey, who is trauma coordinator and a registered nurse at HSHS Sacred Heart Hospital in Eau Claire and St. Joseph's Hospital in Chippewa Falls. As we've been talking about drowning prevention and hearing tips on drowning, and you can visit our program page to stream or download more programs, more tips on different aspects of life in Wisconsin from The Morning Show. You can visit WPR.org/mornings. And while you're there, we welcome your ideas for future programs like you. So email your show suggestions to ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. And thank you so much. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a native Wisconsin pilot who will be making his homecoming at this weekend's Milwaukee Air and Water Show.
The U.S. Navy Blue Angels may be the most recognizable group of performing aviators in the world. Flying at up to 60 air shows in North America each year, the F-18 pilots who make up this unit are among the best of the U.S. Navy and Marine Corps. One of the current Blue Angels is a Wisconsin native, Lieutenant Commander Griffin Stangle, who grew up in Madison. Dusty Weiss got to know Stangle while flying with the Blue Angels.
We're cruising along over the Gulf of Mexico at about 500 miles an hour in an F-18 Super Hornet fighter jet. And in the pilot seat in front of me, Lieutenant Commander Griffin Stangle wants to talk football.
Dusty, are you a Packers fan?
Oh my God, yes.
Okay, cool. My wife's a Vikings fan, so we had a rough weekend, but we're working through it, obviously.
Proof that you could take the boy out of Wisconsin, make him an elite naval aviator, and give him the assignment this year of Blue Angel number 6. But you can't take the Wisconsin out of the boy.
Like, I grew up in Madison. I went to Madison West. I am just a person who decided one day that I'm going to follow my passion and try to be best pilot I can be.
Stengel's journey began 15 years ago. Inspired by a class that he took with Madison pilot Diane Ballwig, he studied aviation at the University of North Dakota and then joined the U.S. Navy. In flight school, he was drawn to the raw power and majesty of flying F-18 fighter jets launched off of carriers at sea.
It's awesome. You could be having the worst day, and as soon as you get shot off the front end, it changes your outlook, and you're just flying, you know?
But flying F-18s is one of the most sought-after roles in the Navy. Stengel says the training and competition were intense. But a decade later, his drive and determination have now earned him a coveted assignment as one of only 260 Blue Angels pilots in history. I wanted to understand just how demanding his job is.
All right, Dusty.
That is why I found myself strapped snugly into the F-18 passenger seat behind Stengel at Blue Angels headquarters in Pensacola.
First, like Max Afterburner.
Liftoff is like a rocket launch. And over the next hour, Stengel subjects me to maneuvers with names like the Split S and the Half Cuban 8.
This is incredible!
But the real eye-openers are the high G turns, where you experience 6 or 7 times the normal force of gravity. If you don't flex every muscle in your legs and core and breathe just right, the inertia can pull all the blood from your brain and cause you to black out.
All right, we're coming to the right for 6 Gs. Ready, hit it.
The Gs don't come on gradually.
There's 6.
It feels like I'm being hit by 1,000 pounds of sandbags all at once.
We're rolling out. All right, brother, how you feeling?
Oh, man, that was a lot. Started graying out a little bit, but do you get gray during that? Or are you just like cool as a cucumber?
We're pretty accustomed to pulling these Gs all the time.
It's all I can do just to keep it together. but it is clear that Lieutenant Commander Griffin Stengel is undeniably in his element here.
Oh, I remember the first time I took off in an F-18. It's a pretty wild sensation.
Are you going to be spoiled for the rest of your life?
You know, there's that distinct possibility. That just kind of reminds me to take every day, give it 100%, and not take anything for granted. It's a privilege to be working with such incredible people who are so dedicated to giving their all every day. Being able to stay a part of the Blue Angel team is just a true blessing.
For 60 precious minutes, I have the opportunity to experience exactly what Stengel is talking about. Sure, I end up drenched in sweat and panting for breath.
Just like that, we're back on solid ground.
But Stengel's ability to perform under those conditions with a chuckle and a grin leaves me with a profound respect for the incredible drive and athleticism that it takes to fly the F-18. And he says being able to showcase that singular talent for the first time over his home state of Wisconsin is a special experience.
Yeah, it's a real treat flying over a city that was a big part of my childhood. Coming home and seeing the places that I went to growing up, it kind of means a lot, you know? You never forget where you come from.
A return to his roots for a proud Wisconsinite who earned his wings.
Dusty Weiss is host and producer of the Lead Balloon Podcast, and he's based in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get an update now on contract disputes involving Teamsters Union Local 662, striking union members at the Line and Kugel Brewery in Chippewa Falls, and employees at a dairy facility in De Pere. You can be part of the conversation on labor contracts and collective bargaining. Call in with a question or a comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dan Boley is a business agent for the Teamsters Union Local 662. Dan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Good morning. Tom Strickland here as well, Secretary Treasurer of Local 662. Tom, welcome.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Good morning, Tom. Let's start with you. These two strikes, Lennon Kugel's Brewery and New Select Dairy Milk, these are the first strikes by Teamster Union members in Wisconsin in about 20 years. Why are these strikes happening?
Well, they're happening because of corporate greed. I think you're seeing that across the nation where corporations don't want to do right by their employees. And the overreach is too extreme. And our members are standing up for a fair wage, fair contract, in which they deserve.
Can you go into that a little bit further? What do you mean by corporate greed?
Well, the profits are at an all-time high for the top. So, for example, here with New Dairy, which is the old Dean's Morning Glory facility, they're owned by Borden's. And Borden's has recorded over $1 billion in profits last year, and they're not passing that along to their employees.
And Dan, Teamsters Local 662 represents about 40 brewery workers at Line and Kugel's, which is owned by Molson Coors, and they want larger pay bumps than the company has offered. Where are negotiations on that issue?
Yeah, so, I mean, we're hoping to get a contract done. As of right now, the company has made, Molson Coors and Line and Kugel's has made no attempt to resolve this issue, which you know, we hope to have this resolved at some point, but we will do what we have to do to make that happen as long as it takes. So as of right now, the company has made no attempt to resolve this issue.
In their statement, they said they've exceeded local market rates for similar unionized roles, and they're hopeful for a resolution that benefits everyone. What do you hear in that response?
Well, you know, when they say they're hoping to reach a resolution, you know, being out here on the picket line, we've seen the opposite. Instead of trying to reach a resolution, the company has put up barricades, hired security. That doesn't seem like coming to a resolution to me.
Tom, how is Chippewa Falls community reacting to the strike since it started earlier this month?
That question would be for Dan.
I'm sorry. Dan, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so the community has been great. I mean, the community support, I mean, every day, you know, members of the community be dropping off water or food, coming by asking, you know, you guys need anything, you know, what can I do to help? That's been terrific. You know, we couldn't have asked for more from the community. And again, you know, with that, you know, with the company turning its back on the employees and the community has spoken as to who they back, Line of Kugels has also turned its back on the community as well.
I wonder, Tom, you know, as Secretary Treasurer of Local 662, how do you communicate and how do you decide next steps with your union members and who have walked off the job and where you go with negotiations?
Well, our situation is similar here in De Pere, Wisconsin, as with Line and Kugels. The company has refused to come to the table for over the last 5 weeks, and they're more or less giving these folks a take-it-or-leave-it offer, which is concessionary by a large margin. And so we'll stay on the line as long as it takes until they come to the table and negotiate in good faith. We'll use the community support, which we're getting great support here too, and, you know, governed by the international, we have a great IBT that oversees all local unions, and they're engaged 100%.
When you say great support, what does that mean? What has that meant for union members?
Well, they get the public support. People come by, you know, the honking of horns, dropping off water. You know, there's monetary things, cookouts, just showing, you know, that they're in, you know, solidarity with us. They believe in our cause. You know, the middle class, you know, is created by the unions, and we set the bar. And I think the working men and women across America have had enough. And now you're seeing more and more job action out there. And it's not because we're greedy. It's just we want a fair shake, and we want to make a decent living for our families.
Molson Coors announced net sales grew to $10.7 billion last year. That's up from $10.3 billion in 2021. How difficult is negotiating a local contract with a multinational corporation? And either of you can field that.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, from what I heard back when the Line of Kugel family owned the brewery, which is some number of years ago, you know, the employees felt like they were part of the family, you know. They were taken care of by the Line and Kugels family and everyone at the brewery. And now that you have a massive company in Molson Coors that takes over, Molson Coors does not view the men and women who work here as employees. They don't view them as people. You're simply a number and a figure to them, and that, you know, that makes it difficult. And so again, you know, to Tom's point, you know, people have had enough of that, and you're kind of seeing that all over.
Teamsters Local 662 officials Dan Boley, Tom Strickland explaining labor disputes of striking members in Chippewa Falls and De Pere. Call in with a question, share a comment about collective bargaining. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Teamsters Union Local 662 as Line and Kugels brewery workers in Chippewa Falls reject wage increases offered by the beer maker's parent company. And in De Pere, another group of Teamsters strikes over a labor contract at a dairy facility. Tom Strickland is Secretary Treasurer of Local 662. Dan Boley is here, a business agent for the local. Call in with the question, 800-642-1234. Tom, turning to the situation in De Pere at the new Dairy Select milk plant, what are the sticking points in negotiations as workers are seeking a new contract since the last one expired in April?
So thank you, Kate, for the question. The sticking point is primarily health insurance. So the company has provided a health care insurance that is very expensive for the employees. We've provided them with a union plan, which gives the employees better coverage at a cheaper cost for both the employer and the employees, and they're rejecting that. They're asking us to pay more for the plan that they're providing, which, and when I say more, I'll give you just one specific. A member that's on a family plan currently pays $54 a week, if I get into a little example there. And under the employee's plan, they're asking them to pay $138 a week.
So
that's a substantial increase, and it doesn't have to be that way. There are savings here for the company, the employees, and the customer with better coverage, lower deductibles, lower max out-of-pocket, and the company simply refusing to offer, do the right thing by the employees. The folks, by the way, that have built this brand, this company. So that's where we're hung up, and we're not going to go backwards. And these members are adamant that they're going to stick on the line until the company does the right thing.
Let's take a call now. Cheryl joining us from Watertown. Cheryl, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. I would just like to say that I agree with your guests 100%. I did work in a factory when I was very young for a short period of my life, and I was in a union. My husband is a former UPS driver, and he worked, 14-hour days, and he basically had to retire because his body was shot. And these workers, this is the backbone of our country, and it is truly the corporate greed and the shareholders that the companies are more concerned with the shareholders than the people that are keeping the lights on and working so hard for these companies. And I applaud these people for striking. And I think that this is really the direction that the country needs to go. We are this the middle class, these working people, this is what built America. And I stand by them 100%.
Cheryl, thanks for the call. Dan Boley, do you hear that sentiment from union members or supporters of those on the picket line?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, that's what makes this country. That's what makes these businesses successful. Without them, none of it would be possible. So,
but does that give pressure to corporations? What is the pressure here in terms of their bottom line business?
Well, I mean, we're going to keep putting the pressure on. We want a fair contract, and so whatever we have to do to get that, that's what we're willing to stand up and do.
Cheryl, thanks for the call. Let's go to Steve now in Sun Prairie. Steve, what's on your mind?
Yeah, one of the things that I think why we see union membership dropping across the country is some of the hyperbole that's used. We just heard a guest talk about how, I think it's Molson Coors is the name of the parent company, said, and I'm not going to quote verbatim, but that they're going to treat people like a number. They don't treat them as people. They're numbers. That's not going to change whatever happens with this union contract. So if you really felt that way, why aren't you coaching your members to find jobs other places? Otherwise, it's just hyperbole to promote hate to try to win a union contract.
Steve, thanks. Dan Boley, what about that? Why not work elsewhere?
Well, the members of the community, I mean, they've loved working at Leinenkugel's for, they were here back when Leinenkugel's owned it. It's a staple of the community. Not only they have friends and family here, but they love the beer itself. We want to keep working here. That's the goal. We want to keep working here. We want to change the mindset and bring a fair wage increase home for our families.
We're talking about ongoing labor strikes, labor disputes at Lannan Kugel's Brewery and New Dairy Select Milk. Teamsters Union Local 662 officials Tom Strickland and Dan Boley with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your question, or you can add your thoughts to the conversation. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Tom, New Dairy is a subsidiary of Borden Dairy and a result of Dean Foods filing for bankruptcy in 2020. How complicated is negotiating a contract for workers after the employer exits bankruptcy and then under new ownership?
It's not complicated. We expect the same obligation from the employer as they expect of us to go to the table and negotiate in good faith, hear the concerns, and come out with a successful outcome. So, we do this every day. We're over, the Teamsters Union as a whole is 1.2 million. And it's not complicated. This company has made it complicated because of their greed. They're not recognizing the employees, the work they do. And to Dan's point, they love the brand. They love the community. This is a well national known brand. And It's $1 billion in revenue last year, and they can't give their employees good health insurance.
I want to return to that point you just made about Teamsters' 1.2 million members. Is that what you said?
That's what I said.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, as you look at Teamsters as a whole, do you see it as a growing in membership, or have you seen numbers decline here in Wisconsin?
Well, to the response, if I can respond to the caller before when he talks about just picking up and moving on to another job, it's not what we do. If our forefathers did that, we wouldn't have the middle class that we have today. And the Teamsters Union as a whole will stand up for workers in the middle class. And I think everyone knows that we set the bar. We set the bar in America. And where there's non-union workers, they can thank a union worker for setting that bar. And in this country, if it moves in this country, the odds are that a Teamster handled it, whether it was through the ports, the airlines, the rail, truck, manufacturing. Teamsters have their hand on it. And our reputation is strong. We build strong contracts. We have great employers, national employers, that we can get contracts across this country daily. It's the employers that are the big Molson Coors, the Borden's Cheese, that don't want to do right by their employees. And it's an overreach to their shareholders, not recognizing the folks that built the brand. My folks here in New Dairy have worked through the pandemic as essential workers. Some of them worked 75 days straight, didn't miss a beat. And we'll take this thing to the street and to the customer, and we'll ask the community for their involvement. But we will succeed in this.
Tom Strickland, how strong is union membership, and are these two strikes an indication of more labor insecurity in Wisconsin?
Our union membership is strong. 100%. These two locations, the company talks about, I think, on both strike lines that the offer is good and fair. Well, if it was good and fair, we wouldn't be holding a strike. And so it's clear for those that don't understand the process, we don't call the strike. Our members call the strike. They vote on a contract, and they tell us when it's not up to par, and they ask for the action. We support that.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Dan Boley is a business agent for Teamsters Union Local 662, representing workers at Lannan Kugel's Brewery in Chippewa Falls. Tom Strickland, secretary treasurer of Local 662, spokesperson for striking union members at New Dairy Select Milk in De Pere. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.